Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Alaska Zoo, where University of Alaska professor and eco-tour guide Terry Johnson is sharing his notes and observations from the Walrus Islands in Bristol Bay. Recorded on April 14th as part of the Wildlife Wednesdays lecture series, take a tour of the Walrus Islands in Bristol Bay on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans. Coming up next, after the news.
Are you guys ready for the last Wildlife Wednesday of the season?
Yeah.
That was a little too enthusiastic over there. I'm actually a little bit sad to see him go for the season. It's been a great time. This is, of course, the first year the Alaska Zoo has hosted Wildlife Wednesday here in our Gateway building. And it's been a wonderful experience, and we've had some great presenters, including Terry, who I'm going to introduce to you in just a minute. It's been a fun time, and we're looking forward to hopefully doing this again next year with the agreement and cooperation of our lovely partners for the series. And I would like to mention them, in particular the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Alaska Department of Fish and Game, for all of the work they've put into scheduling speakers and logistics and helping us to advertise. And we've also got quite a few other partners, too. The Nature Conservancy, Defenders of Wildlife, the Library, Alaska Geographic, and of course, last, the Alaska Zoo, who has been happy to host this. So, and we hope that you guys will keep an eye out on our website. We will have some lectures in the summertime. They're called Tuesday Night at the Zoo. They are sort of geared towards a family audience, but they're a lot of fun. They're in the evenings every Tuesday in the summertime. And we have a wide range of topics for those, and we'll have them on our website here pretty soon. We do have those inside our zoo grounds, and we usually try to include some interactive elements with the animals, so it's a lot of fun. And then, of course, hopefully you'll be looking for October and the beginning of the next Wildlife Wednesday season. So, having said that, we're very excited to have Terry Johnson here this evening from the UAF Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program. And he has about 15 years of experience out in the Walrus Island Sanctuary, in particular Round Island, and taking ecotourism groups out to view walruses in the area. And it's a fascinating topic, of course, with all the changes happening in the environment. So we're excited to have Terry here, and I'll hand it over to him, and we'll go ahead and get started.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Yeah, thanks to the zoo and all the partners for inviting me out here. This is kind of a thrill for me to be able to talk about my favorite place and some of my favorite animals. My day job is with the University of Alaska Marine Advisory Program, and in that job I work with the tourism industry and recreation and commercial fisheries and a lot of related things. And then in the summers, for the last dozen years, I was running, taking time off from my university job and running trips out to the Walrus Islands, primarily to see walruses and also other wildlife and just basically the country around there. So what I'll be talking about this evening are these subjects. We'll just be skipping lightly over the top of several different subjects here. The first is walruses. The second is the Walrus Island Sanctuary. The third is other places out there in the Togiak Bay area. I have a few comments and observations about visitors, the people who come to look at wildlife, and about the ecotourism business. And then a few tips about wildlife viewing and collecting of parts. And finally, just a couple of comments about what walrus populations appear to be doing and what some of the effects are that are, what some of the factors are they're having, apparently having effects on walrus populations. First of all, is there how many people here are marine mammal biologists? One? Okay, good. So that's fine. That's a relief. Because I'm not a biologist, and I do a lot of reading, and I spend a lot of time looking at animals, and it's always really interesting for me to talk to biologists because they know a whole lot more about various aspects of these animals than I would ever know, and I always like to get corrected and updated. So if you know something more about something I say than what I know, don't hesitate to let me know about that. Secondly, how many here have been to Round Island? Number of people. Okay. All right. Well, then, some of this will be familiar territory to you. So, first of all, about these pictures, I'm not a talented photographer. I'm not a professional photographer. I only switched over to digital a couple of years ago, so I have actually kind of a limited selection of pictures that I could use for this presentation, but rest assured that it didn't take any fancy equipment to do this. I have a cheap digital camera with a variable length lens, no special equipment. The only real factor I think that really makes a wildlife photographer is time. You just have to put a lot of time in on it. When you see Geographic or you see the magazines and you think, oh, they shot that there, I'll just go there and get the same kind of picture. Well, they probably spent months in that spot, on that scene, waiting for exactly the right light or exactly the right movement. So you won't see any exceptional pictures here tonight, but these are just what the average duffer can do if they put a little time in on it. All these pictures were ones that you could have gotten if you had been there, except two that were shot under special circumstances that the average visitor wouldn't have been able to shoot. So I'll try to remember to point those out when we get to them. Otherwise, these are all things that you could do yourself. And, I already said that. The only thing that, if there's anything here that you think are good pictures, is just because, you know, it's like the give a monkey a typewriter and enough time, he'll eventually write a novel. Well, that's kind of the way I am with photography. So here's the object of our affection. There are two, and some people say three, species of walrus: the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the third one is called the Laptev walrus that lives in the north of Russia. And it's some question as to whether it's a separate species or not. The name is derived from the Greek Odobinus. The species, the genus name is derived from the Greek meaning tooth walker, because at some point back in early history, people noticed them moving across the ice, locomoting across the ice by using their tusks as picks to drag themselves across the ice. And Rosmarus pertains to the pinkish color that they get. And the Pacific species is the divergence, because they were originally named in the Atlantic. They're pinnipeds. You're probably aware there's three kinds of pinnipeds. There's the phocids, or what's commonly called the true seals. There's the eared seals, otariids. And then this third group called the Odobinids, which are the walruses. And this may seem like sort of nitpicky kind of scientific jargon until you start looking at the differences among those three groups of animals. And they're really very dramatically different in many respects. The way they locomote on land, the way they locomote in the water, the way they how they orient their bodies, how they move their bodies, their life histories, their reproductive cycles, all those things are very different between the seals and the sea lions and then the walruses. And to add confusion to the matter, a lot of the things that are called seals are actually otariids or eared seals, like the fur seal, North Pacific fur seal, for example. But never mind fur seals. We're talking about the Odobinids, and they are they share some of the characteristics of both the other groups. For example, their locomotion on land is more like typical of the otariids, in that they can rotate their hind legs forward, they can prop themselves up on their four legs. They can kind of shuffle across the ground, in some cases with some semblance of a little bit of speed. I wouldn't say they're exactly racehorses, but they can get around, and they could actually feel threatening in some cases if they were to come after you. Whereas the foes that you're probably aware, like the harbor seals, all they can do is hunch along because they can't rotate their hind flippers. On the other hand, the walrus propulsion in the water is more similar to a fossid like a harbor seal because they use their hind flippers in an undulating manner like this, whereas the otariids, like the sea lions, actually fly through the water with their four flippers. So they share some of the characteristics of both, and then in other ways they're just different from everybody else. One way that they're different from almost all of the other pinnipeds is that they have virtually no visible fur. The other pinnipeds all use fur as insulation, and some of them have quite a rich pelt, like the fur seal has quite a rich pelt. The walrus has fur, but it's very short and very sparse and doesn't really, it's kind of a vestigial fur. It doesn't really contribute much to their insulation. You can see fur, there's patches of fur, but it's very short. This, of course, is the time of the molt, too, so they're probably other times of the year, they probably have more fur than this, but this time of year, they don't have much at all. I sometimes still believe that a walrus is the size of a Volkswagen, smells like a barnyard, and is as graceful on land as a sumo wrestler in a sleeping bag. Because they're just enveloped in this huge envelope of blubber, which, of course, is their insulation against the cold, and they can store a tremendous amount of energy there. Walruses are what's called pigophilic, meaning that they're ice lovers. They're ice-associated. And one of the things you always have to keep in mind about Bristol Bay and about Rhode Island is it's one of the very few places where walruses routinely come in contact with land, because most walruses spend their entire life at sea, either on the ice or in the water. And in fact, by some measures, they probably spend most of their lives underwater because they have long feeding periods. And when they travel much of the time underwater too, because it's more efficient than traveling on the surface. So this whole envelope is a big survival suit to keep them warm and to provide just the perfect amount of buoyancy so that they can easily be either on the surface or submerged without any effort to get down. If you watch some of the other marine mammals, like a sea otter, for example, it's got to do a lot of work just to submerge because it's so buoyant, but a walrus just slips below the surface with almost effortlessly. They have all kinds of really interesting characteristics, one of which is their kinds of communication, verbal and nonverbal. I'm going to try to play you a little bit of... You also hear some other voices there. That comes out of the front end. Some of the other sounds come out the back end. The gonging or chiming is done, they have fringe sacs, air sacs, on either side of their neck that they inflate. And when they sleep at sea, they actually inflate those. It looks like a life jacket. And they actually sleep upright, drifting along with their heads back and their tusks out if they're at sea. And these pharyngeal sacs are buoyancy, but they can also transfer air from one side to the other. And when they do, it passes over a kind of a vocal cord, and it makes this sound that's sometimes called gonging or chiming. It sounds like a bell buoy. They also have some other interesting sounds, which I might be able to play for you later, that's a hammering sound that's actually teeth clacking, that you can often hear with hydrophones and occasionally out of the water. you can see, well, you can see the vibrissae, you can see the way eyes are set way back on the sides of the head. Can you see the nostrils? My observation is that their default mode is actually closed. If they're not conscious, you know, if they're sleeping, their nostrils are closed. And you actually often see them lying right at the edge of the water with their heads in the water as the tide comes up. And you think, oh, geez, this animal's going to drown. But they don't, because their little nostril flaps are closed unless they take a breath. And they can apparently actually sleep and then awaken just enough to open those nose flaps, lift their head, take in a breath, and then go back to sleep. Because they live in such a cold environment, they have a whole complicated system of thermal regulation. And I just use this picture to illustrate. Can you see that the one animal to the right there is almost white? This is because the way that they conserve heat in the core of their body when they're at sea is by constricting the blood vessels to the periphery, so all the blood is kept in the core, and the skin goes basically without blood, so it becomes this bleached white color. And then when they come ashore, at least if the weather's warm at any rate, like it is in the summer, then they turn a bright pink because all the blood then just rushes to the periphery and you get this flushing. And then after they've been ashore for a little while, maybe a half hour or so, that pink kind of fades out and they become a brown, more typically brown. So there's one that's just coming in from the sea. That's a classic. You can, one glance, you can tell he's just arriving. The populations are almost completely divided between the males and the females with the calves. And they spend most of their lives that way, other than the winter when they come together for the mating season. And you rarely see a calf or a young or a female. This is one of the smallest that I ever saw at Round Island. You can see it's distinctly smaller. And here, that is the smallest I ever saw at Round Island. I don't know how that little guy ended up there. He doesn't even have visible tusks. When you see a young one there, it's almost always trying to attach itself to a big male as a protector, because the other adults will attack it. They're really quite cruel, and they'll chase away and they'll beat up on it. And very often one of these little guys will get sort of taken under the wing of one big guy, and as long as he stays with the big one, then he's fairly safe, and the big one will chase off anybody who's trying to be mean to him. If you spend a lot of time looking at them, and certainly there's people who've spent a lot more time than I have, but I've noticed a number of interesting behaviors. There's all these hierarchy things about who gets the softest spot on the rock and who doesn't want to be bothered when somebody's passing through, and lots of these head gestures is a way of establishing rank structure in the community based on the size of the tusks. And all that, all of you who have biology backgrounds probably recognize this sort of display behavior. Those tusks are probably, all in all, more important to them for display than any other purpose, although they do some fighting, there's no question about that. And, of course, then they also have the purpose of helping them haul out on ice. They use them as ice picks to pull out. And they'll use them on the rocks as well to climb up rocks to get a purchase to climb up rocks. Of course, I haven't been out on the breeding grounds in the winter. Might be a totally different situation out there. But in the summer, the jousting, the fighting is, I think, I wouldn't call it severe. I one time got a call from a film crew in Australia who was making a TV series called something like Tooth and Claw or something like that. And they wanted to come to Alaska and get footage of this vicious fight to the death between the walruses at Round Island. And I frankly told them that, you know, that you'll see them poke at each other a little bit, but you're not going to see any really vicious fighting. And, you know, I'd hate to have you spend a lot of money on a trip and not get what you're coming for. And they were very appreciative of that because it saved them $10,000 in travel money. This is about as vicious, about as serious an injury as I've seen, and as you can see, it's not much. They have such a thick hide such a thick skin layer and then so much blubber under that that for the most part these little jousting events don't result in any damage. The only exception would be if they poke out an eye, obviously, and they do sometimes break their tusks. They break their tusks fighting or they break them clambering around on the rocks. So a walrus without tusks feeds just fine. It doesn't affect its ability to feed itself at all. It probably affects its love life a little. It probably doesn't get as many girls with broken tusks, but it survives just fine. So they're, this funny mix of an animal that's extremely shy in one moment and very blasé the next. Sometimes you can just drive right up to them. These close-up pictures that I took from my boat, and they actually approached the boat. They just swam right up to me. They're curious. And other times, just the slightest provocation, and they just panic. They just act like they're just scared to death. They'll do a little routine like this, and they'll dive. And I one time at First Beach at Round Island, perfectly peaceful scene, one quiet summer, sunny summer afternoon, and a murre on the cliff on the far side left its nest, took off, not nest, but a little ledge where it was, and as it did, it kicked loose a pebble, and I heard this pebble go tick, 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 and that pebble hit the beach, and 100 walrus just panicked and dove into the ocean just like that. Walruses have been important to a lot of people for a long time. Native people have used them for virtually every part of them. Their hides, their tusks, their meat, their intestines are used for storage containers and lots of things, and people are still using them. There's still a subsistence hunt at Round Island. It's very limited and very tightly controlled. It occurs in the fall. Further north, there's a lot more use, subsistence use of walruses. Several thousand a year, it's estimated, are killed overall in Alaska, on the coast of Alaska, by native people, primarily for food, but also for the other parts that are useful. There was a commercial hunt for them at one time, and as recently as the 70s, I believe, fleets on the Russian side were hunting walruses pretty consistently, and they were using them for fox food, and collecting the ivory, of course, and the hides. Their hides are so thick and so tough that they were actually used as drive belts on machinery. I mean, they were cut into strips to use for drive belts on machinery. All right, subject two, Walrus Islands. The first state game sanctuary established in Alaska after statehood was the Walrus Islands State Game Sanctuary. This was because it was well known that there had been walruses on all of those islands, or at least most of those islands, historically, and they were vanishing. They'd vanished from all of them except Round Island, and I think the original intention of the sanctuary was to create a safe place so that they would eventually return and eventually recolonize those other islands. That, however, has not happened. They occasionally, a little group occasionally, will drop in at Crooked or one of the others, but in general, it's just never occurred. Round is still the only one that has any regular use. The sanctuary consists of four islands, major islands, and three rocks. And the only one that has limited access is Round Island. So this is Dillingham. This is Naknek and King Salmon. If you know where Bristol Bay is, this is basically the main part of Bristol Bay right there. The village of Togiak is up here. So this is Round Island. It's about 10 miles straight across to the mainland. Then Crooked Island, High Island, Summit Island over here, and then Black Rock and two rocks here called the Twins. And this area here comprises the Walrus Islands sanctuary. But there's really few restrictions. The other islands are all uninhabited, and they're beautiful places, but there's not much reason to go there. And, fishing boats anchor up, and that's about all there is to that story. It's Round Island is the place that everyone has focused their attention on. And, you know, this shot's from the mainland with telephoto lens, and it's just a rock sitting way the heck out there, you know, 10 miles out in the ocean. And I was just talking today to Joel Garlick Miller, who's the main, one of the chief wildlife, walrus biologists for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And I said, so how the heck do they find that place? And he said, I wish I knew. I have no clue how they navigate, how they orient themselves. And why, for that matter, why this island, of all the places that they could go, why they picked that one? I'll get back to this in a minute. There are several terrestrial. At one time, there have been documented 56 different terrestrial haulouts on both sides of the Bering Sea, Russian and American side. And most of them are abandoned. Most of them are not used. There are four other haulouts. The other places that they used to occur, I mean, in recent history, regularly, was Cape Pierce and Cape Newingham. And then they started showing up. Unfortunately, it's not on the map, but down right about down here is Cape Senevan, or it looks on the map like Siniavin. It's between Port Hyden and Port Moeller. And that's turning out to be quite a large haulout. When I was first doing this, there were no walruses there, but they really moved in down there. Now, just in the last about 3 years, they've started using this beach right here at Hagemeister. So what they're doing is basically changing their distribution in the Bristol Bay area. So there's this marvelous convergence, you know. Every year, all these walruses and all these seabirds and all these sea lions and everybody else spreads out over thousands of square miles of the North Pacific, the Bering Sea. The birds go way the heck down to the Western Pacific, and the shorebirds go all the way down to South America. And the tourists are all over the place. And then every year, come about June or July, they all converge on this one little rock out in the Bering Sea, each for their own reason. And we get visitors from every continent, not every country, but they come from all over, primarily to see these animals. Not large numbers of tourists, however. The tourists are far outnumbered by the animals. The average return has been fewer than 100 visitors a year for many years now. Some years fewer than 50 or around 50 for the whole season. It's really a wonderful place. Sometimes I think it's almost a shame people tend to be so much focused on the walruses, because the island itself is just a very beautiful, very scenic place. Constant, you know, the vista's constantly changing with the weather, with the fog, with the wind. Some dramatic rocks. This is called granodiorite, is my understanding. It's an intrusive magma. It was lava that flowed through a fissure in the crust of the earth and solidified, and then the land around it rose and pushed it up. And I don't know geology very well, but it's basically a kind of volcanic formation. It has all these interesting chimneys and stacks and things. Its mood is constantly changing with the weather. It has a number of good viewing locations. This is a spot called Flat Rock, and there's an overlook. You can see where the people are. And this is sort of typical walrus viewing out there. This is the campground area. There's a campground with, I believe now there are eight camping platforms, and they're connected by trails. I think it was well after this whole thing was set up, the campground and everything was set up, that it was discovered that this was an extremely important prehistory site. And the archaeologists were out there about 2 years ago, and they found, they did digs and they collected all this stuff, and they found evidence of habitation going back 6,000 years, not continuous. There were a couple of different waves, different cultures of people came and used Round Island for a while and then sort of disappeared, and then another culture group came after them more recently and used it. And it was used by native hunters from Togiak and Twin Hills for walrus hunting until 1960, when the sanctuary was created. And as part of creating the sanctuary, they banned hunting. And so no hunting was allowed there. So Native people had no reason to go out there anymore until about, I don't remember now, about 8 or 10 years ago, when the Board of Game changed the regulations and allowed a very limited hunt in the fall. So now local Native people go back out to the island in the fall for walrus hunting. But there are more than 100 cultural sites right on that little hillside there that the archaeologists have identified, little pits that were house depressions, or they were they had other cultural significances. And there's other animals out there, too. I'm a particular fan of the Steller sea lion. There's a little Steller sea lion colony down at East Cape that's been growing in recent years. There's a lot of them there in the spring when the yellowfin sole come in, and then when the herring come in to spawn. And as soon as the herring spawn and leave, the sea lions, most of them vanish. But there's 100 or so that hang out there. There's a couple of families of red fox every year. All the dens are kind of known. They're used year after year. And in the early in the year, you know, the biologists out there are always saying, oh, this one's got this many cubs, pups, and this one's got that many. And there's always a new crop in the spring, but by the end of the summer, they're back down to about the same number that they started with, because there's real high mortality of fox, young foxes. Some seabirds there, nothing really extraordinary, but just nice, pretty birds to look at, pigeon guillemots, black-legged kittiwakes with their chicks. I like these little guys, parakeet auklets. They have a real cheerful song, and it's kind of the sound of Round Island to me, the song of these parakeet auklets. Both of our popular puffin species are there. Good. It's a good place to view these birds. There's nothing really unusual, but it's a good place to get good close-up look at them, observe their behavior, get pictures of them. Common murres. Cormorants, a couple of species of cormorants there. All of them have nest and have their chicks. And if you follow the sequence of the seasons, you can watch from laying to hatching to fledging. And some ducks, too. Harlequins, there's a little group of harlequins that usually is hanging out there. And it's a wonderful place for wildfires. I didn't bring in my whole wildfire collection, but Monk's Hood is one of the signature plants of the island. So here's some notes about visiting, in case you haven't already but are thinking of going someday. A couple things to know about it. First of all, wouldn't it be nice if you could just hop on a plane and fly out there? But no, you can't. Airplanes are not allowed except under some very limited emergency circumstances. When I was in the business, I would bring my boat around to a bay on the mainland coast and anchor and go ashore with my inflatable boat and hike across a little beach dune to a lake, and the float plane would come in and land, and people would get off and I would take them out to my boat. And I would just run a fairly short distance, depending upon which beach I use, from 10 to 15 miles out there to the island. The other way to go is through the village of Togiak. It's a much longer trip, much more exposed to weather conditions. And the big problem with Togiak is a huge mud flat that runs for miles out from the village. So you're very limited in the amount of time each day that you can get in and out of there. And, of course, that changes each day with the cycle of the tides. So it's a more difficult deal to go via Togiak. But there is a guy in Togiak with a little outboard boat, and he will take you out there if you arrange it in advance. The island, as you can see, is very steep. The whole west side is basically just cliffs, and you can't get there, and if you could get there, you wouldn't want to be there anyway. So all the action is over on the east side. The boats come into Boat Cove right there, and then there's trails. This area around here is sort of relatively flat, and these are the main viewing areas, Flat Rock at Boat Cove and First Beach and Second Beach, And then East Cape is, there's no walruses there, but that's where the sea lions are, and then that's it, end of the trail. The other way you can go over this way, go up a steep hill to Observation Point, which is where it has good bird viewing. And then after that, if the trail is open, the only other thing you can do is go right straight up the side of the mountain, just right straight up the side onto the Traverse Trail, and you can get out to here, and there's a end of the trail here just before the spine. And if there's no animals on any of these east side beaches, then that's the only place you'll see them, is out there at Main Beach. It's actually quite a friendly place, weather providing. These are probably the youngest kids that I had out there, but I had a number of kids over the years. They all did fine. It was no problem. You just had to be sure they didn't fall off a cliff. Other than that, no problem. They like it. This is the campground. The campgrounds have, they're in tall grass, so they're somewhat sheltered from the wind. There's platforms to put your tent on. Back in the early days when I was out there, there were no platforms, and the mud would get really wet, and you'd be sleeping basically in a swamp. Your sleeping bag would slush in the mud under the floor of your tent. But it's very civilized out there now. There's even a weather port to cook in and an outhouse, and it's really uptown there now. I don't know why I stuck that picture in there. I just liked it. That's a view of from out at that point that I was showing you, out at Main Beach. But even with a telephoto lens, that's as close you can get to them out there. So off from Round Island to other things to see out there, that's the Twins, the next island over to the next little group of islands to the southwest. They're also part of the sanctuary, but there's no there's a few sea lions and tons of birds, but no place to go ashore. This is Black Rock. I often take people there because it's accessible and it's really a wild, wild place. There's a few harbor seals that live there, and then just tons of murres, just thousands of murres packed onto those slopes. This is over on the mainland. The whole mainland for many miles, hundreds of miles, between Dillingham and all the way up almost to the mouth of the Kuskokwim River is the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge, and it's almost all completely wilderness, and it's just a really wonderful place, but of course it's inaccessible, and I get to go there because I have a boat, and so I love to go around and find all these interesting places. And this is over on Nunavutchuk Bay. It's just a rock formation there. There's a lot of wildlife over there. I don't have any good bear pictures in this group, but it's a great bear watching place. I often just sit on the boat and watch brown bears doing what brown bears do, and caribou and occasional moose and coyotes and everything you can think of is out there. It's another spot over there on Nunavutchuk. I call that the elephant legs. It's a formation in the rocks there. This is kind of a local icon. It's called Stone Lady, and the local people have a story that goes with it. It really does look like a woman in a kusbuk, Eskimo kusbuk, standing out there looking out to sea, waiting for her husband to return. And if you hike up there, there's five bear trails that converge right on this monolith. And I don't know why. I don't know why they go there, but the bears just love to go there. And people leave things. There's all kinds of little crevices in the rock there, and they leave coins and jewelry and little mementos, rifle cartridges, and all kinds of things are left there. Well, just some quick thoughts about ecotourism. I just wanted to mention a couple of things. I spent 12 summers with a lot of visitors. It's a kind of a happy business. People come out expecting to have fun. They usually do. Ecotourists tend to be, I think, a little bit easier to please than some other kinds of tourists because they simply appreciate the environment. They don't measure the success of their trip based on how many things they catch or kill or whatever. But it has some elements to it that I maybe didn't expect. One is I was really shocked to find how many people have never confronted wilderness before. And many of them say, I've never done this. I've never seen a place that didn't have lights and didn't have roads. And some people are frankly quite intimidated by it. And some of them find that just the physical work of going up and down hills really challenging and in some cases kind of frightening. And so I say it stretches some people. Some people come out and say, this is great. This is something I've never done. I'm glad I did this. And other people say, I guess I'm older than I thought I was. You know, I guess I'm not the adventurer I thought I was because this is harder than I expected. And I've got many stories about people that I hope are not viewed as reflecting negative on them. They're just interesting insights into people's lives. And I had a guy one time who was a African wildlife photographer, and he gave me a copy of this beautiful book of every kind of imaginable African animal that you'd ever heard of. And we were walking up this trail, and he was just beat. And he said, oh, I just can't do this. This is the hardest thing I've ever done. And I said, well, wait a second, I don't understand. How did you get those pictures of all those lions and gazelles and stuff? And he said, oh, that's all from the Land Rover, you know. In Africa, you don't get out of the car, you know. And I'd never thought about that before. And a lot of people come out and the first thing, you can always tell it's going to go, the first thing they say in their opening statement when they meet you is they somehow slip into the fact that they've been to Antarctica, you know. It sort of establishes their status as an adventurer because they've been to Antarctica. And and so I think, well, that's great. I've never been to Antarctica. That's great, you know. Well, then I find that they have a little trouble getting in and out of the boat on the beach. And I'm sort of, and then you find out that, well, actually, they've got about six big Russian sailors who pick them up and lift them out of the boat and set them on the beach. And that the ships actually have a dock that they lower by a crane to the water so that people go down a grand gangplank onto this dock and into the inflatables. So I hope I don't sound like I'm making fun of anybody. It's just that there's this whole world out there of people who whose lives are just really different from what I've ever experienced. And I've traveled. I've been 50 some countries, but I've never had the money to do this kind of trip, frankly. And the other thing I learned is that wildlife tourism and ecotourism leads to what I call competitive tourism. You know, it's people will sit at the table on the boat and they'll try to sort of one-up each other with where they've been. Or if it turns out the other guy's been in the same place, well, I was there before, you know, that guide. Or I did it the hard way, you know, I didn't have, I took the cheap trip or something like that. So it's a kind of a cross between one-upping based on all the places you've been, but also one-upping on what a hard time you had getting there. That establishes your rank in the ecotour pecking order. But anyway, that's fine. It's a wonderful kind of life for folks who can do it. And I always thought, well, you know, it creates a constituency for wildlife, and it supports a few small businesses, and it's, I mean, what's not to like? It's a completely morally justifiable kind of activity. And then I learned about carbon footprint. So now I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's morally justifiable or not, but I love it anyway. A couple of tips on wildlife viewing. I mentioned that there were two pictures in here that were not quite ethically done. Well, you should never see a herd of walruses doing this. This is a bad thing. I have a defense. I was doing a bird survey under direction of a biologist from the Department of Fish and Game, and he wanted to get in close to that beach, and I said, you know, we're going to spook those walruses, and he said, well, I know we probably will, but, you know, we have to get in to count that, to examine that cliff, and so do the best you can, and I did the best I could, and we almost made it. We were past them, and suddenly they bolted for the water, and so I snapped a picture to illustrate what you don't want to see when you're doing wildlife viewing. And it's the same is true with sea lions or harbor seals or anything else. This is not, when you see this, you've failed to keep a low impact on the wildlife that you're viewing. So I won't go into a lot of detail. I've got a bunch of information on responsible wildlife viewing, which I would be delighted to share with you anytime. Since I'm past my cutoff time, I won't go into it tonight, but I'd be glad to talk to you about it. Likewise with collecting, you may be aware that there's all kinds of restrictions on what you can pick up off the beach, off of dead animals, including birds. It's essentially, basically illegal to collect bird feathers or animal parts or anything. There's some exceptions. One is marine mammals that are not on the endangered species list, which walruses so far are not. It is legal to collect hard parts like tusks and usiks and things, as long as they're registered with the Fish and Wildlife Service. Anything that's on the endangered species list, which includes most whales, most baleen whales, other than grays, you can't have. You can't legally possess. So that's a terrific oversimplification. There's a lot more to it than that. Again, I'd be glad to go over it with you in detail if you want to know more about it. So where are the walruses going? Well, the total number of walruses appearing in Bristol Bay has been decreasing over the years. The pattern at Round Island and some of the other haulouts has been changing. The last two summers, they've been really scarce for long stretches of time at Round Island, which is part of the reason why I didn't go back last year. In my business, if you're a transporter, you know, people take their own choice chances, and they... If you leave them out there for 5 days, chances are during the 5 days they'll see something interesting. It'll be fine. But when you're guiding, you have a fairly short trip, 2 or 3 day trip, you just can't take people's money and haul them out there and then have them not see what they came to see. And there were stretches there last summer and the summer before when there just was no walruses to see. And I'd never seen that before, and it kind of shook me, so I decide to step back and kind of stay out of it for a while and see what happens. Where they're going? Well, who knows? There's not enough known about walruses and how they move around. It is clear that there are fewer in the Bristol Bay area, but it's also clear that they've redistributed themselves. Big haul out at... even Main Beach that day had very few on it. And that's there's usually thousands on that beach. I mean, in previous years, there were thousands. There's a lot of them at Cape Senevan. This is only as part of the beach. That beach runs for a half mile or so, and Cape Senevan population has been growing. This new haul-out started up at Hagermeister Island about 2 or 3 years ago. It's down on the south part of the island, and it's been inconsistent, but fair numbers have been showing up there, so this may be a displacement. They may be leaving the ones that have been using Round Island may be moving on to these other locations. Which brings us to the final part of the talk, and I don't know much about it, so I won't say much. What I do know is that as the sea lice, that walruses being pagophilic and being ice-associated and spending most of their haul-out time on the ice, they use it as a platform, they rest on it, they have their babies, and they use it as a staging place to dive down into relatively shallow water, which most of the eastern Bering Sea is, to feed. And as the ice retreats from the shore out over deeper water, they get out over depths that they can't reach anymore, so they can't get to the bottom, so they can't feed. So they suffer food stress. The other part is they have to haul out someplace, so some big assemblages have occurred up in the Cape Lisburn, icy Cape area, where there have been these newly established terrestrial haulouts, where big numbers of them are hauled out on the land. Well, these are animals that are not accustomed to being hauled out on land, and they're not really very good at it. They make mistakes, and the big mistake they make is that when they get disturbed, they panic. And when they panic, they trample each other, and the losers usually are the small ones. And so there's concern that they may be losing year classes, or at least big parts of year classes, due to these crushing events. Now, the problem hasn't been documented as seriously here as it has on the Russian side. There have been big stampedes over there in which it was believed several thousand, one whole year class, was believed wiped out of a large group over there. because something disturbed him. A polar bear disturbed him, or a low-flying airplane or something disturbed him. So any way you look at it, a warming climate is not a good thing for walruses. Walruses thrive on ice. Ice is their home. When there's less ice, they're like, in some respects, they're like the polar bear, that they just, their life is just not as good as it used to be. And the usual result of that is either food stress or decreased reproductivity or increased mortality, the result being a generally lower population. It's believed that their populations peaked about 20 years ago and they're been gradually on a decline that isn't necessarily related to loss of sea ice, but it's probably a contributing factor along with forage and other things. So since I'm over my time, I'll stop right there. Be happy to take questions or talk to you afterward. Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA with EcoTour guide and University of Alaska professor Terry Johnson. Following his talk entitled Notes and Observations from the Walrus Islands in Bristol Bay, recorded on April 14th in Anchorage, he responded to questions from audience members.
How many predators do the walruses have?
Well, the main predators are polar bear on land or on ice, and killer whale in the water, and people wherever they can find them. Not much else can eat. Not much else can get through that hide. There is, by the way, some dramatic footage that Diane Akanak out at Round Island shot of a killer whale attack on walruses out there a couple of years ago.
Terry, are you familiar with the issue on Cape Pierce with the walrus that fall off the cliffs? Could you describe that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. At Cape Pierce, there's a peninsula, and the one side of the peninsula is a cliff that drops down to a rocky beach. And on the other side of the peninsula is a sandy slope that slopes down to a broad, sandy beach and a shallow little lagoon or little bay there. And back in the days when there were a lot of walruses at Cape Pierce, which there are not anymore, they've largely abandoned the place. But back when I was first in this business, I used to actually do a lot of trips to Cape Pierce because there were thousands of walruses hauled out right on this sandy beach, and you could do the low crawl through the ryegrass, and you could crawl right up almost to them without disturbing them, and it was really a cool place. But what happened on at least three occasions was that animals came up on that beach, and then more animals came, so they moved further up, and more animals came, and that whole beach packed just solid. And I've actually got some pictures that are not digital, some old print pictures of that beach just packed with walruses right up to the top. And the top ones up there would get heat stressed, or they'd get fidgety or whatever, and they'd just go roaming, and they'd get over to the other side, which had a little steep grassy slope and then a cliff, and they look over the side and they say, oh, there's my pals down there, and they'd unch a little closer, and then gravity would take hold and then they'd fall off the cliff. And the biologists who were out there at the time got some video of it, and it's the most heartrending sight. You see them, you're looking up and you see this walrus and he's getting closer and you're saying, no, don't do it, don't do it, oh no, and then shoo, boonk. And of course an animal that, it's only like 25 feet or so. So it doesn't kill them instantly. It just like breaks every bone in their body, but they don't know they're dead yet. So they get up and they try to struggle and they try to get away. And then the next one comes and falls on them. And it's really a pathetic sight. And there used to be dozens of carcasses on that beach. They called it Maggie Beach because of all the maggots, because there were dozens of dead walruses and that had fallen off that cliff and died there. And it happened two or three times one year, then it didn't happen again for many years, and then more recently it happened. Yeah, it's happened again. And when I say they don't use, I shouldn't say that they don't use Cape Pierce. What I mean is it's very sporadic, and the numbers aren't as big as they used to be. So from a tourism point of view, it's not really worth the trouble to try to organize trips out there because you can't really predict when they're going to be there.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Terry Johnson, sharing his firsthand observations of walrus based on a decade of taking tour groups to walrus viewing areas in the Walrus Islands of Bristol Bay. In addition to being a tour guide, Terry Johnson is a professor with the University of Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program. His talk, entitled Notes and Observations from the Walrus Islands in Bristol Bay, was recorded as part of the Wildlife Wednesday's lecture series at the Alaska Zoo on April 14, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.